Hey, Leland, I just finished watching X-Men First Class.
Yes, I did the same thing.
We need someone to train us to use our superpowers.
Yes, we do. Our incredible latent superpowers that could be honed and focused to give us the power to, say, eat too much ramen better.
Or, like, sleep in a half an hour after we were supposed to wake up, but make it super restful.
Or convince ourselves that threesomes are the best thing.
We're already
superpowered-ly.
The best.
X-Men First Class. We're going to learn about this and more.
Vestryman from the future. Bow! Because it's going to be the future soon. I won't always be this way. When the things that make me weak and strange get engineered away. It's going to be the future soon. I've never seen it quite so clear. When my heart is breaking, I can close my eyes. It's already. Welcome to Vestryman from the Future, Season 2, Episode 0.785, Special Feature Number 16.
Yes, we're going to talk today about the X-Men First Class movie. I'm here with my co-host, Cable Nachos Shane.
And I'm here with my co-host, Leland. I should be an Irish superhero, Webb.
Arr!
Wait, not a pirate.
Wait, aren't the Irish like pirates? On with the podcast.
We rarely let there be dead air, but I literally had nothing to say there.
So we're going to talk today about the X-Men First Class movie, which was an X-Men effort by Matthew Vaughn, produced by Bryan Singer, who both, I believe, worked on both X-Men and X2.
They were both involved in that. Neither of them was involved in X3.
We don't think.
No.
We've also tried very hard to forget X3.
It was stupid.
This movie basically exists, as far as we can tell, to maintain IP rights for Fox Studios over the X-Men franchise.
Yeah. There was no reason this movie should be any good at all. Like.
And yet, it kind of is, and we're going to talk about some of the whys and why nots.
I will link you to the Movie Bob post about this, where he talks in depth about the IP issues.
Which means that we can avoid talking in depth about the IP issues, because we really don't care. It doesn't matter much to me, to be perfectly honest, whether Marvel Studios or whether Fox... 20th Century Fox is making a movie.
It matters a little bit to me because Marvel Studios has made better and worse movies, but they've never completely missed for me.
I'm trying to think if that's true.
Both the Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, and Avengers.
Hulk was under Fox. Okay, so yeah, I think we can safely say that Marvel Studios actually has a better track record with their production than Fox does. But that being said, we're not here to talk about those
movies. And Fox
movies.
Has made some phenomenal movies. Yeah.
So moving on to less about boring stuff like intellectual property and producers, and on to stories about the adolescence of the X-Men and the Cold War and
Kevin Bacon. Yeah. Kevin Bacon is 6 degrees from Kevin Bacon in this movie.
So basically the premise of this film is we start out with Magneto and Xavier's sort of origin stories.
Childhoods,
at least. I don't know if the X-Men really get origin stories, because most of them aren't created superheroes. They're just born.
Mostly it's, hey, remember that time my powers came and something terrible happened? Which is generally how it goes if you're an X-Men and not Professor Xavier.
Well, and that's because the X-Men, among so many other things, are an allegory for adolescence.
Yeah.
And realizing you have superpowers is an allegory for going through puberty.
Realizing you have reproductive
sometimes
organs.
You're going through puberty in a Nazi concentration camp where someone will shoot your mother.
God,
So, two things. One, I would watch... They should not have made this movie. They should have just made a movie called Magneto Nazi Hunter.
Actually, yes.
And just blown those parts of the first act out to a three-act thing where he goes... Shaw doesn't even have to have superpowers, right? You can just make that super... That Nazi guy at the beginning who ends up to be Sebastian Shaw just a Nazi. And Magneto just runs around and kills Nazis.
Well, that's kind of what I assumed we were going to basically see. This is a film, like so many films, told in basically three acts.
Yes.
And the middle act is a training montage.
Yes. An awesome, awesome training montage.
Let's start with the first act. We'll do things chronologically, though. Sure. In the first act, the movie does not want to do that.
No. The movie doesn't want to do anything in the first act.
I may have been a little bit half awake for the first act of this movie, or maybe... Like, there was a loud dog prancing around.
Or Leland's sister might have been making a lot of fun of the first act of this
movie. But the first act of this movie is not strong.
No, it's...
It's got moments where it's strong, but it's also got some of the looser expository writing I've seen on a
film.
Yeah,
there's a lot of... Like, there's a lot of stuff that's a hair breadth away from being a voiceover and might be better as a voiceover. Because if it was a voiceover, they could have shown us something interesting while it happened.
We do a lot of watching Magneto, like, sit around and brood while he plans his revenge as an adult, a young adult.
Now, the actor playing Magneto...
You want me to figure out who that
was? Yeah. I was hoping I could point at you and our audience would never know that I didn't know who he was.
No, we're not doing that. Yeah. So Magneto in this film is played by Michael Fassbender.
Who I should actually know.
Fassbender. We hate names on this show.
And he does a really solid job of being emotive as all get out in the first act. He provides a solid experience, a solid emotive relationship with a character who's basically doing a lot of sitting on his bed, staring at the wall, sitting at a bar, angrily drinking beer, sitting at another bar, angrily drinking beer, and then trying to drown himself with rage, literally.
So this guy's career up to this point has included a lot of video game voiceover work and a lot of TV. After this movie, he'll go on to be David in Prometheus. So
that's a pretty big
this is a
turn.
Big jumping off career point, I think, to some extent. And he does a very good job as Magneto.
The strength of this film is the characters. He might be the most compelling character in the film, too.
Now... I find that James McAvoy's Xavier in this movie, I spent so much time wanting to punch him in the teeth.
Which I think you were supposed to.
Yeah. He's
supposed to be elitist and a little out of touch.
Yeah.
And
so I think what we can say about that is that certainly I think this is a movie about Xavier and
Eric Lesher.
Yeah, about
Eric Lesher.
Eric. And I think that they've got strong leads.
Yes.
And I think they basically carry the movie.
They have a pretty deep and compelling supporting cast. The only person,
including
Kevin Bacon, who plays the antagonist and does a Kevin Bacon-y job.
Basically no consequence. I think my problem is not with the acting.
No.
Throughout the thing, I'm...
The supporting cast actually
I'm
does a good
job,
I'm
very comfortable with the whole supporting cast, top to bottom, aside from some of the military people who deliver very jingoistic military-y performances.
Which I'm not sure we can hold them so accountable for.
My problems, especially with the first third of this movie, are the script.
Yeah.
It is doing this thing where we're doing a time shift between mostly Magneto's childhood and his vendetta. I feel like there is a ton of time that just should have gone to the cutting room floor in the first act.
Yeah, I have the same feeling. I mean, Xavier and Raven get one really good scene.
They do. And honestly, Xavier gets a number of really good scenes. But I feel like I understand what they're trying to do. They've got this sort of juxtaposition of, like, Xavier hanging out at bars, getting drunk with academic associates, hitting on girls, and
using his psychic powers to so creepily a girl.
Yeah, he's a little bit of a psychic date rapist. Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd go to date rapist, but whatever. Continue.
And then that's juxtaposed against Eric mostly brooding in hotel rooms and staring at walls of information about old Nazis that he wants to kill.
Well, and the problem is all of Xavier's stuff is interesting and engaging, and it might not really be going anywhere in the first act, but at least there's a lot of really good character work being done. You're getting a multifaceted look at Xavier. On the Eric stuff,
He just broods. He's just really angry dude.
He has two action scenes, but mostly those scenes are even him brooding, and then a little bit of action, and then some more brooding. Like,
see, and what I think what I would have liked to see would be take out all the brooding, let the character stand on its own without doing these like long, annoying expository sequences. Cut the whole thing down and tighten it up, and show instead of juxtaposing Xavier being kind of a comfortable, well-off academic and Eric being this loner, this angry, angry loner dude, just show Xavier drinking 2-liter bottles of beer with college co-eds and friends, and then show Eric killing people.
Yeah, I mean,
just right, get to the fucking monkey.
We don't get any depth from the... We get one thing told to us over and over and over.
Yeah, we don't
Eric
learn
scenes.
Anything. And pretty quickly...
We learn that he speaks a lot of languages, but that takes 30 yeah. seconds.
Pretty quickly, it gets boring.
Yeah.
It also wasn't helped by the fact that the copy of this film we watched, for whatever reason, they hadn't pulled the subtitles for the foreign language portions of the film onto this rip. Yes. We stole X-Men First Class.
Yes,
sorry, Fox.
I'm never sorry to Fox. Like, I'm sorry. What was his name? Lashbender?
Fassbender.
That sounds like a superhero name.
Yes.
Non sequitur, since we're talking about names, we get Raven's first name, but we never hear the whole name Raven Darkholm on screen because it's a stupid name.
It really is a stupid name. First of all, don't name your child Raven.
It's possible she named herself that in this continuity.
Yeah, we don't really... she pretty clearly doesn't...
Have a mommy.
Have a mommy.
Yeah.
So back to what we were talking about. We got these long, long scenes where Eric's walking into people's offices and speaking a lot of German or a lot of French... And since we didn't have subtitles, we were having to sit there and infer what was going on. And it was fine. We were able to do this thing.
Yes.
But since neither of us speaks very good German or French...
I think there were definitely ends of those scenes where Magneto looks into the camera, or Eric looks into the camera, and like says something that's clearly supposed to be witty in French or German, and we did not get those jokes.
Yeah, it was... So that might have made it seem a lot more tedious than it actually was. That's my disclaimer. But I also think that when your writing is so dialogue comprehension dependent, that you've got scenes that are just downright boring to watch if you can't understand the dialogue, you really need to go back to 1919 and watch what we were doing in feature-length films before this whole synchronized audio thing was an option. Because nobody outside of, like, an intense character drama piece wants to watch two people talk at each other.
Well, and even in those, you have more than one emotion being... more than one thing being done in every scene.
Yeah.
If your scene is about showing that Magneto's a badass, that's actually kind of okay, but it should be a 40-second scene.
Exactly.
Or maybe a two-minute scene, not a 10-minute scene.
Well, and even the scenes where he speaks English.
Boring.
They're just.
In fact, I found them more boring because I
wasn't expending any energy trying to figure out what was going on.
Well, and the acting was actually, I couldn't focus on how interesting the interesting acting choices that were being made.
Well, and I was also more distracted by some of the poor dialogue choices being made when I could understand the dialogue. Oof. The dialogue in the first third of this movie is not great.
No. And so six people worked on the film, and I feel like they were like, and people remember the end. Let's put our A team on act two and act three.
Honestly, the feeling I got is that they're worried that I'm not going to catch things. So they tell them to me over and over again in three different languages.
Four languages. Because Spanish, German, French.
And English. Yeah, so that was pretty tedious. At the same time, we're having kind of fun stuff going on with Charles Xavier. We're developing a really interesting relationship between him and Raven, which, since this is kind of a soft prequel to X-Men and X2... that is very interesting, keeping in mind the character of Mystique in X-Men and X2, where she is basically emotionally very disengaged from...
And super silent. You're interested. I mean, I feel like she's just spent too much time around Magneto, who is just an anger font.
Yeah.
And she's just got super angry.
Because she's actually... an extremely interesting character in this
movie.
She's
so freaking likable. I mean, at the end of this movie, if you are rooting for the X-Men, I think you've done something wrong.
Yeah.
Like,
because really, they're all kind of jerks, but they're young and they have these untempered enthusiasms. I actually think that comes across very well in the writing.
Yes, it does.
Raven's whole thing is that she's an extremely vulnerable young woman who's trying to figure out where she fits into stuff.
And she's got serious body image issues.
Yes.
Which take the form of she's blue.
Well, and she has an interesting character arc where she is torn between the approach of McCoy, who's got the same serious body image issues, and his dream is to... overcomes those so that people don't have to know that he's different. And Eric, who really, really wants her to embrace herself for who she is. And it's actually a little disconcerting because we, I think, want to root for McCoy. He's a geek. He's an awkward young man. He just wants to be liked. We want to root for him. And Eric... is a little bit sleazy, a little bit like he's too old for her. He's very much more worldly than her. We want to be a little sketched out by that, but also we know that Eric's giving her the tools that she needs to be a happier person.
To self-actualize, yeah. Right? Like, well, and I mean, we also want to be rooting for Xavier because he shows up first. We're told he's the hero of the film. We're supposed to want to like Xavier, except for, I mean, he's not a dick to Raven. He's just her only friend, and he's super disengaged from her life.
Well, I don't think he's even super disengaged from her life. He just really doesn't want to see her turn blue ever.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, we know from the first scene they spend... the first two scenes they're together, he's comfortable with her being blue in private.
He's just constantly encouraging her to
hide who she is.
Once again, we want to root for Xavier because he's been the guy who...
he's a pacifist. He's... like, in the second act, he becomes so likable because he's clearly just awesome at getting the best out of his friends.
Yeah.
Which is... a great character trait.
But at the same time, we like the message of be comfortable with who you are and be a badass more than we like the message of make sure everyone else isn't too scared of you. It reminds me of being a smart kid in elementary school. It reminds me of thinking, do I want to be the guy who answers the questions in class, or do I want to be the guy... who sits back and knows the answers.
I remember I remember thinking the other kids won't like me if I sit in the front of the class and literally have the answer to every question that is asked.
Yeah, this is, I think, exactly the same type of discussion that we're having. And I think that in many ways, the Magneto side of the fence here is the adult approach to the world. Yeah.
I mean, Magneto's older than Xavier is in this story.
Yes.
He is less emotionally mature. Except for in the... He's like,
maybe. He's just really angry.
Yeah, he's really angry. I think he saw his mother shot in front of him when he was 8.
I think he's more emotionally mature. I think he's just got way darker demons than Xavier.
Yeah, I mean, he does have darker demons than Xavier.
And Xavier is a better... is a better mentor for people, a better teacher in some ways. But,
in some ways, I mean, but, except for when it comes to emotionally figuring out who you
are. But Eric is a better, a much better father figure or, I mean...
I don't know if this character, as we're sold him, could do that in the medium or long run.
Maybe not. I don't know.
I mean, and we're kind of given Xavier as the mommy of these first X-Men and...
And
Eric,
Magneto is the daddy.
Daddy. I mean...
I think that's clearly what's going on here. And
you're... God, it's so... The third act is so frustrating in a good way because you're looking at what they've accomplished together and thinking, God, those guys would have made a cool world.
Yeah.
If they could have got over a little bit of ideology about whether or not humans could be trusted.
Well, and the interesting thing about it is at this point... their ideology is divergent, but certainly neither of them is crazy. We have Kevin Bacon for that.
Yes, Kevin Bacon wants to nuke everyone because maybe there will be more mutants if he nukes people.
So this film, in many ways, I think takes some cues, fairly heavy-handed cues, from spy movies of the 1960s.
Particularly Bond.
Literally, the villain in this movie is a Bond villain.
Yeah, I mean, down to wearing the right petticoat.
Yeah. Like. And the, you know, he has a classic blonde bombshell who's his sidekick.
He wears a ridiculous helmet for no reason.
It's to stop the telepathy, man.
And well.
But yeah, basically...
Well, and so Magneto can steal it later.
Yes. But basically the whole movie is hung on this of this 1960s Cold War era spy film, and the bad guy, the antagonist, is a very uninteresting villain. He's got basically one motivation, which
is sociopathic.
Yeah, make himself very, very powerful, and he wants to destroy the world.
Yes, like down.
with nuclear weapons and submarines.
Yes, I mean it's he literally has his nuclear. I was so happy when they're attacked. So he's on a yacht. They attack the yacht. The yacht starts to sink, and they all run to the submarine, which disattaches from the yacht and sails away.
Yeah, it turns out the yacht is just like the above water facade of the secret submarine.
So. Bond. like so Dr. No.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean right, I mean also interestingly we were told in the media this would be a spy movie. What we didn't know is it would be a 60s spy movie where the spies don't do any much spying.
Yeah.
Like
in fact
there's maybe one extended scene where they do a little bit of spying.
Well, we do find out that what's her face rolls around town with some very unpredictable lingerie on under her
so Emma Frost is gonna be rolling around in underwear. That's like one of her three character traits: hottie, telepath, and wears underwear. She's awesome. I like that character, and I don't even mean in a pervy way. I mean, that character has generally had some great moments in comic books over the last 10 years or so. Moving right along. No, that's Maura McTaggart wears improbable underwear.
Like, her and her partner, whose name I cannot for the life of me remember.
Because it's said one time and doesn't matter.
Are staking out the Hellfire Club, presumably looking for communists.
Because McCarthyism.
And they decide this is kind of deeper. How can we get closer? Well, it's a Las Vegas club or something. They're bringing in all these hookers. And so she... without any fanfare or warning, suddenly rips off her clothes in the passenger seat of the car and just walks out to pose as one of these whores.
But is wearing, like, stockings.
Like, was that how the 60s was? Because I am down for the 60s.
Let's go to the 60s where all the ladies are ready to take off their clothes and give them the slightest provocation.
And let's be clear, this is not like... This character is not put out there as a sex pot, really. She's not big time sexed up. She's wearing this super conservative CIA, you know, kind of Men in Black suits type of getup. She's sitting on a stakeout, probably not your like sexiest activity. That sounds like a lot of being in a car eating Chinese food.
Or donuts.
And not sleeping.
Is there Chinese food? It's the 60s, so there might not even...
There's Chinese food in the 60s.
Yeah, I guess there is.
But anyway, and then suddenly she's like fucking thigh highs and garter belt and all...
It may just be because it's a movie, too. Maybe we shouldn't think about it too much.
I know that it pulled both of us kind of out of the moment. Yeah, like, what?
Okay. I mean, she's nice enough to look at. She's in a movie where the sex pot looks like a Bond sex pot, and by that I mean kind of like pretty but boring looking, she is really interesting looking.
Yeah, she's an attractive woman. Yeah. I didn't have any complaints about the visual that was being presented to me at all.
No.
And there was no shortage of fan service being presented on the screen in that scene.
No.
It just felt really weird. Like, yeah. Like it would be akin to if the agent needed to seduce some women. So what he did was suddenly grabbed his CIA suit pants by the cuffs, whipped them off to reveal that he'd been wearing a tearaway suit the entire time and was wearing a man thong.
Yeah.
Pulled out a boombox from the back seat of the car and went trundling in. Like, that is exactly how that scene felt.
Yes.
And I think the only reason it even played at all was because it's a female character. Because no one is going to buy that, like, CIA agent by day, but God, you never know when you're going to have to become an adult entertainer at a moment's notice.
Yeah, no. It's hard to believe.
Maybe she just has a very active and adventurous sex life.
Or maybe they cut the scene where she walked over to a lingerie shop, bought it, and walked in.
We were talking about, there's another scene in the movie where Beast presents the X-Men with their outfits for the big mission at the end. And Xavier looks at it and talks about it and then closes the box. Oh. And my sister, who's kind of half-heartedly watching the movie with us, goes... Why do you close the box? Don't they need to take the outfits out and put them on? And Cable goes, yeah, if this were a Joss Whedon show, we would have totally had this scene right now where one of the kids turns to him and goes, don't you need to pull those out so we can get dressed?
Because Joss loves the like big climactic big moment and then undercut. He loves it. He loves it a lot. He didn't do it at all in the Avengers movie. Well, maybe he did. Maybe he had a 20-minute action sequence followed by dudes eating shawarma.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I think that was the shawarma scene.
Yeah, that was the shawarma
scene. God, I want some shawarma.
I always want shawarma.
Can we wrap this up so we can get shawarma?
Well, there's also they catch the White Queen. I don't know how they're containing her because she's a telepath and she can clearly read their minds, but let's not even get into that. And they don't give her any clothes. Like, she's a prisoner, and she just apparently sits in this room in the clothes they captured her.
Well, yeah, they capture her. She walks in to seduce this Russian something.
General, I think.
Yeah, he's some sort of military politico. And she walks in wearing... I've got to say this, and maybe it's a little bit fruity. I love the costumes in this movie.
Oh, man. They are so unapologetic. I mean, except for Sebastian Shaw.
Who mostly walks around in a sexy turtleneck.
Well,
looking
yeah.
very German, which he is German.
Are you confusing Sebastian Shaw and Eric Lessinger?
Or no, you're right. Eric Lessinger walks around wearing a sexy turtleneck, and Sebastian Shaw runs around wearing yachtman clothes.
Yeah, yachtman clothes and like
but that's totally 60s, right? Yeah, like right. I mean, well, you can picture
movie goes on, he wears more and more Bond villain
clothes. he is straight up doing like Hugh Hefner out on the town for the entire movie.
Yes, he is.
The costumery is awesome.
It is.
Anytime that like one of the female characters has to like go take care of something, they're all walking in like these amazing like over the top 60s dresses with like fucking capes and knee high boots.
It's so much fun. Like comic book. So X-Men said, like, what would you rather we wear, yellow leotards, was the joke in X-Men 1. They were kind of embarrassed about comic book wear. And then Thor happened, right? And Thor was like, I don't know, we're just going to put everyone in exactly what they wore in comic books. Yep. And it was awesome. And comic book movies that are embarrassed by their costumes have made a mistake, I believe.
Yeah. Well, so we have this scene that you're talking about where Emma Frost is locked in this weird cage by the Russians, if I remember correctly.
No, by the CIA
after they go do this other thing. And I'm assuming that the cage itself has some like anti-telepathic properties.
Well, except for she can clearly read their minds.
It's really confusing. But she's in there in the same outfit she was using to do this mission for Eric. And she's
Sebastian.
You're right.
They wear the same helmet, so I know why you're getting confused.
She's working for Sebastian at that point. She joins up with Eric later. And it's this like tiny white dress with this like outrageous cape
and fur, like
fur line and shit. And she's just sitting there on this like slab of like operating table style bed.
And we're told the X-Men have been training for a week between.
Yeah, which means she hasn't changed her clothes. They just threw her in there with whatever she was wearing because they really want us to see women in Bond girl outfits so badly in this movie.
And comic book inspired Bond villain outfits, which may speak to Leland and I in a way that the world is unprepared for.
No, I think that this entire movie though recognizes that this is going on. They recognize that they're doing kind of a silly thing. They're doing a 60s spy movie. They keep coming back in the dialogue to these moments where there'll be a whole room full of men and then like one woman. And all the men will turn to each other and say something that is so ridiculously Mad Men and would be really offensive, except it's played off as like, yep, we're doing a genre film.
It's pretty offensive, but it's like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, look how far we've come.
That's what you get for allowing a woman in the bureau or in the agency.
We're sending you back to the typing pool, they keep saying to her. Jesus.
All in all, it's pretty awesome.
We'd give it a thumbs up if it was a thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yeah, but it's got some problems, and it really has some pacing problems to start out with.
It has dialogue problems the whole way through. Yeah. It just delivers, I mean, half a dozen solid performances. So, like, it's hard. And really, and a compelling as crap Magneto origin story.
Yeah. One thing about this movie that really struck me upon finishing it, credits rolled and I thought, what did I like about this movie? What didn't I like about this movie? And I thought, what movies were similar? Well, immediately James Cameron's Avatar came to mind for me. That was a movie that had some really solid performances, but I was distracted throughout the entire movie by the presentation of the military corporate complex and how paper thin I thought they were. This movie had that exact same problem for me. All of the CIA guys, all of the generals, all of the military people, all the government people, Russian, American, German, it doesn't matter. They all are portrayed as these sort of paper thin caricatures of goose-stepping goons. And it's so we can make a heavy-handed point about how I think Eric sees the...
And how Xavier should see those bitches. I mean, you can make an argument that you want to reform them.
But Eric is we are never allowed to forget for more than like 5 minutes at a time that Eric's a Holocaust survivor and that he went through this concentration camp experience.
So he doesn't trust. I mean, he's got a problem with authority. Yeah.
And all of the authority, all of the governmental authority in this movie is basically directly compared to the Nazis.
Yes.
And that's how I felt. That Avatar was, and I thought it was weak there. I think it's weak here.
Yeah, you want some more depth coming out of that, especially to make Xavier not seem like a Looney Tune.
Yeah, exactly. Xavier just seems like he is so
hopelessly naive.
Yeah, and I don't know.
Actually, Eric asked him at one point, "Are you hopelessly naive?" And the answer you have to take away at the end is. Yeah. Yeah. Remember that time when you were all sitting on the beach and you beat the villains and they tried to nuke you out of existence?
And
I guess conventional weapon you out of existence. Whatever. They shot like every missile they had and every gun they had at this beach.
Yeah, they didn't even ask questions. The point of that scene was Eric was right.
Yeah.
Eric's right.
MagnetoIsRight.com is a domain that you should go and read because this movie is another argument for, yeah, fuck, I don't know, we should probably all be mutants. Like, we should probably kill all the humans because mutants are better than humans. Like,
you elitist fucker.
me or...
Yes. you and Magneto.
Me and Magneto. I think actually the elitist here is Xavier. Like, he's deluded and like he's got this belief system that won't allow reality to intrude into it.
Yeah.
I mean, and Magneto is emotionally fucked and like making bad decisions in the last 10 or 15 minutes of the movie because he's a Holocaust survivor. And
but they're both, I mean, they're both guys who are trying to build a logical way forward where mutants can have a happy existence in the world.
Yeah, rights and security.
Which is different than the antagonist in this movie, Sebastian, who wants everyone to nuke each other so that he can absorb millions of kilotons worth of nuclear powers and be the most powerful mutant in the world, basically.
And if you read every mutant story that's ever been written as a analog to the civil rights movement, I think that's interesting. I'm not sure if it was done on purpose, but there were probably black dudes in the civil rights movement who were just in it for personal power.
Oh, I'm absolutely certain there were. In fact, I think
they were dangerous.
You can make the argument that that personal power has often come into play as a factor in who rises to power in any movement, and sometimes the results are good,
yeah.
But sometimes great things come out of very bad intentions.
This is fair. Well, and there's nothing wrong with personal power, but when like when your drive for personal power is so overwhelming that you're willing to nuke the world basically out of existence, which is an analog for what a lot of people are willing to do for power.
Yeah. I mean, I think
murder, enslave, kill. You know,
there's a statement here
work
that
for banks.
Yeah, and that I think banks. On either side, the bad guys, whether they're Sebastian or whether they're the U.S. or the Russian government, they believe that the solutions to their problems will be found through a massive display of power.
Yep,
and the good guys, the guys who will be the powers that be in the mutant movements, both Magneto and Professor X, both have much more subtle and much more nuanced approaches to their ideology.
Yes.
It's just one of them doesn't believe that they can ever live
peacefully
with...
And he's right at the end of the film.
Yep.
He's not the villain of the piece. He might be misguided and he might be overzealous, but he's not wrong.
Nope, he's pretty clearly right. And I think
and his rallying cry at the end is let's build our own society. Let's go to Ethiopia and build a black actually in comics he goes to Africa and builds a African mutant nation.
So we've proposed I think on several occasions in conversations that these two characters, Magneto and Professor X, are originally fairly clear analogs for Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes.
I think that we really are once again seeing something along those lines, except that I don't think MLK was ever quite the rakish academic that they present X as.
Maybe not. Also, Malcolm X's argument that we can all work together only works if there's white kids in the South registering black voters. Right? Like, I need to know that there are humans that are willing to take huge risks, and all we're told is Morrow McTaggart is... I guess there are two humans who take significant risks.
And I think that's the key to this, is that we have McTaggart, who is an unrepentant and unquestioning mutant sympathizer.
And we have... does he even get a name? The guy who runs the CIA base?
Oh, the geeky guy.
The geeky guy.
Who gets dropped from a great height by...
Azazel.
By Azazel.
Yeah.
Well, so I think that pretty much wraps up the major themes of this film. I think it's certainly worth a watch. It's a really interesting, if you assume this film is actually a prequel to the X-Men movie, I really like this portrayal of Magneto leading into Sir Ian's portrayal of Magneto in that movie.
That's the part of it that works best. You have to ignore some incongruities. They decided to write a script that would work and ignore where it conflicted. It's almost the Dwayne McDuffie approach to continuity of like, yeah, we're going to ignore the fact that Beast is going to be weird in the third movie and played by Frasier, and we're going to ignore the fact that Mystique and Professor X have a really intense relationship.
And yeah, we're basically going to forget about that.
But the Magneto plot arc works beautifully.
Yes.
And Professor X's works beautifully, too. Professor X is walking the line. Like, the ethics of mind control are an ongoing question, which you will see through both X-Men and X2. So... And we're looking forward to Days of Future Past, which is coming out soon. We will
not just because that is the title of a Moody Blues album.
Or because it's the title of a great X-Men story.
But because it has the same creative team as this movie, and maybe they will have gotten their writer sloppiness in order. This movie did very well. This was a $353 million movie.
And it was made
on a fairly low budget.
Well, because it wasn't supposed to... make any money. Maybe, it wasn't produced to make money.
Maybe with a bigger budget, maybe with an expectation of success, maybe the sequel to this movie comes out and it's really kick-ass.
Yeah.
We'll
see. If it's as good as this, we'd like to see it. Next week we'll be off because it's Christmas and we don't want to give you all Christmas gifts. But I'll post something funny, so that can be your Christmas gift.
You're such a generous man.
I know.
I'll repost some crap I found on the internet, guys.
That's what I'll do. But hang out for something exciting in the new year.
We'll make it up as we go along. Thanks for listening.
Last week I left a note on Laura's desk. It said, "I love you," signed anonymous friend. Turns out she's smarter than I thought she was. She knows I wrote it, now the whole class does too. And I'm all alone during couples skate. When she skates by with some guy on her arm. But I know that I'll forget the look of pity in her face. When I'm living in my solar dome on a platform in space. Cause it's gonna be the future soon. I won't always be this way. When the things that make me weak and strange get engineered away. It's gonna be the future soon. Never seen it quite so clear. When my heart is breaking, I can close my eyes. It's already here. I'll probably be some kind of scientist, building inventions in my space lab in space. I'll end world hunger, I'll make dolphins speak. Work through the daytime, spend my nights and weekends perfecting my warrior robot race. Building them one laser gun at a time. just hope that I can keep them from destroying the earth. Cause it's gonna be the future soon, I won't always be this way. When the things that make me weak and strange get engineered away, it's gonna be the future soon. I've never seen it quite so clear. When my heart is breaking, I can close my eyes. It's already here on earth. They'll wonder as I piece by piece replace myself, and the steel and circuits will make me whole. But I still feel so alone until Laura calls me home. I'll see her standing by the monorail. She'll look the same except for bionic eyes. She lost the real ones in the robot wars. I'll say I'm sorry, she'll say it's not your fault. Or is it? She'll eye me suspiciously, hearing the whir of the servos inside. She'll scream and try to run, but there's nowhere she can hide. When a crazy cyborg wants to make you his robot bride.